In the 1970s, Ralph Bakshi created some of the most eye-popping animated films that the American landscape had ever seen, exploring sex, drugs, race, all in a forthright matter that had been unprecedented. Bakshi drew upon his experience growing up in Brownsville, numerous photographs, and rock and roll to feed his body muse. Today, Bakshi paints and has largely turned away from animation, claiming that he's burned out. But as our conversation revealed, there were larger issues that caused Bakshi to stop. Incidentally, less than an hour after this interview, Bakshi called me on a street corner, informing me that the original closing song for American pop was Freebird. Okay, so I am here with Ralph Bakshi, who is known for Fritz the Cat, Coonskin, American Pop, a number of films, and
Heavy Traffic. Heavy traffic and I think Cappuccino.
Yes, and also Cappuccino. We haven't discussed that particular film. That film is very hard to find. I had to go through eBay to get that. It's one of the most frightening film I've ever seen. But how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm all right.
Okay. Well, first off, I wanted to ask you about music in your films. I mean, it's certainly important in American pop, you know, not just that, but also you've pilfered from your record collection for that, as well as the Maybelline sequence in Heavy Traffic. And, of course, I'm a Nigger Man from Coonskin.
Well, I wrote that.
You wrote that one.
I wrote that.
But I'm wondering if you did this because you may have a possible aversion to Carl Stalling-style orchestral music in film.
Okay. There are two or three reasons why that happened, all of which are part of what I believe in, that you don't need a lot of money to make good films. It's not necessarily helpful. Or young filmmakers should use their heads. If they have no money, how could they still get form of quality on the screen? Okay, first of all, I love music. I've always loved music here, and I've loved various kinds of music. I love music to death, and music is part of our lives. It's part of the soundtrack of what we all grow up with, especially in my day. I don't know today, there's so many things going on. I'm talking about yesterday and my day. Which are 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, okay. Music is so emotionally important in a movie, it's just as important as anything else. If the song is emotionally correct for a scene, the scene plays better, or the scene plays better than it would have with a different song. So music is so critical to movies. I chose songs that I knew emotionally worked for these scenes that I wrote, because whenever I listened to music while either driving a car or sitting at a bar or listening to Coltrane or Billie Holiday, is you daydream. If you don't daydream to music, then you're not listening to good music. So music is about dreaming, it's about hope, it's about the future, it's about movies. It's crucial and critical and more important than the writing in the film, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, now, I went out and I bought every record that I've ever loved that was right for the scene. Yesterday's by Billie Holiday and Fritz the Cat was perfect for Big Bertha and Coming into Harlem. You know, it's a classic song. Maybelline and Twist and Shout. And all these Scarborough Fair, all these records I used, I got for $50 to $100. You gotta pay for them from the record companies. And they were dirt cheap. I could buy any record I wanted for under $200. Why was that? Unbelievable. Because everybody else was scoring their films. And why were they scoring their films? Because if they had a hit, they'd own the music. They'd make money from the score. They'd make their own records. I can't release Billie Holiday's Yesterday's and make any money on it. I don't care how big I never considered that. That wasn't the issue. The issue was what was right for the movie. I couldn't believe the cheap prices I was getting. And I had a low-budget film, so I could afford to get anything I wanted. The music in American pop, what I got, cost nothing. The reason it took pop 20 years to get out on DVD and video, that's right, 20 years after I made it, was when they went back to the same companies, because in days before video and home video and DVDs, there wasn't that right, so no one ever made a deal on the music rights. So after I got all this great music at Spit, when they went back, the music money the companies asked for were more than what I paid to make the whole film. Uh-huh. It was up to $8-10 million for the music rights. So they finally arrived at some negotiation. I don't know what they did. But after 15 years, finally they got the thing out. Because I was getting songs at 100 or 200 bucks a piece. You know, Springsteen, blah, blah, blah. George Gershwin, you know. That's entertainment. So I think music is crucial. And I was lucky enough to pick the music I loved.
But I'm wondering if you have a particular aversion to orchestra. I know, for example, for Lord of the Rings, you were at one point thinking about having Led Zeppelin music.
Not at one point. I was thinking all the way. But Saul Zent, who did the music, I hate Leonard Bernstein's music in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I don't like him at all. I thought it was cliched and Gregorian chants. What else is new? I wanted Led Zeppelin because they were right for the film. They were hip. The film was being read by every hippie in the country, and I was one of them. You know, The Lord of the Rings was for us in the East Village. It wasn't for anybody uptown. And Led Zeppelin represented to me that kind of brilliance. Mm-hmm. And how it would play against the ancient visuals of Middle Earth. But of course, Saul Zenz, who put up the money for Lord of the Rings, owned his own record company and couldn't sell Led Zeppelin after, so I didn't get it, and I was disappointed. And I didn't like the music in the ring.
But you also had Andrew Belling on Wizards, and I'm curious if you gave these composers specific instructions, or...
Well, Andrew Belling on Wizards did an absolute brilliant job. Okay, let's talk about Wizards. Wizards is very low budget, $1.2 million, okay? I'm not going to fall back on my records because it's not that kind of movie. I need a score, okay? I need a score. It's my first score. But I need a score that I love. And I don't remember how I got to Belling. I've interviewed a lot of guys. But Belling came in with a little synthesizer. One little machine in those days, which was a very big deal. We didn't have any orchestra. We had synthesizer. All that music was done with Belling in the room, electronically. And he said the right things, and he did the right things, and he came back and he played me a piece of music. It was absolutely beautiful. I think Belling did an incredible job on Wizards, and that song he wrote, and the battle scene, and the emotion. Belling nailed it. He did it himself. He wrote it and everything. He scored it. It was all done without an orchestra. It was done with a machine. That's all. So, and it was done very reasonably. I didn't have much money. It was a scored kind of film because it was a fantasy. You know, and it didn't feel right to put old rock in or even jazz. It just wasn't right. For some, Belling nailed it. It's one of my favorite scores of any film, is what he did on Wizards.
Well, this is an interesting conundrum because going back to what you were telling me earlier about how music creates a daydreaming mode for you to execute a scene. It's certainly, I think...
And right.
But now here you are. I mean, like, I think one of the reasons the Maybelline sequence in Heavy Traffic is so stirring to me is largely because of that music.
That's right.
And I'm wondering...
I totally agree.
Yeah. But here you now have a scenario in which someone else is composing music that doesn't originate from your original source. In a way, you're kind of matching your subconscious onto the film by having
a
pop song.
I was terrified what he would do.
Yeah.
I was scared. I was nervous. I mean, I had nightmares and it wouldn't work, but you know, I wasn't sure. Yeah. And he nailed it. I don't know how he did it. It had nothing to do with it. I take no credit for what Belling did. He came in and said, listen to what I did. I went, oh my God, it's perfect. I don't know how he did it.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do with it.
Did you give him any records that you might have been listening to or anything?
Nothing.
Huh. Interesting.
I talked to him for hours. Maybe I talked about Tangerine Dream. I don't remember. Was Blade Runner in or out? Was Blade Runner made or not made at that point?
It was 82, Blade Runner.
No, this was earlier then, right? So I love the music in Blade Runner.
Tangerine Dream.
Yeah, I just love them. So maybe there wasn't anything I remember that I could have possibly spoken to him about, unless it was Tangerine Dream that has similar overtones electronics, but I don't want to take anything away from Belling.
Yeah.
How do you talk to another composer about music? Now look, let's talk about freedom. I demand freedom as a director. I demand the right to fuck up, to do whatever I want. I am not about to take that freedom away from another artist. If Belling walks in and he says he's a composer, and I believe what he has to say, and I believe he's sensitive enough, and I believe he got it, Man, prove it. Go do your music. It's not my job to write the music for him. Mm-hmm. I take no credit for the Wizard's music other than the fact that I accepted it. I could have thrown them out. Another producer could have said, this is terrible. Yeah. But I loved it from the first time I heard it. So Belling nailed it. I work with Belling tomorrow in a second.
Oh, interesting. I wanted to ask you about the trajectory in American pop from ragtime to punk.
Right.
I've had this interesting email discussion with a few people who are also into your films about whether Bob Seger's Night Moves was included, whether this was intended as an anticlimactic conceit on your part after punk, or whether there was a legitimate quality to the song. And so I have to put this question to you.
Night Moves sucks. I had another song that they just wanted too much money. I forget what it was. And the last second, they turned me down.
Really?
I had cut another song that was, I forget what it was. I try to remember. I blocked it now. I was so furious. And Night Moves was something I was playing earlier on in the film that I had to throw in. We had to deliver the film. And the film I had in there was brilliant, the song.
Yeah.
To end the picture.
And you can't remember that song.
I blocked it. I'll remember it. I will think about it today. If I remember, I'll give you a call.
Okay.
But I hate Night Moves. It was the wrong song at the wrong time in the wrong place.
I was right. I had a feeling on that.
No, that was terrible. I was crying. And screaming.
How soon was it before the film's release that you had to lock this in?
2 weeks.
2 weeks
before I went to negative.
And Night Moves was the last.
Well, we had the other song, and the guy said he'd give us the rights, but then he tripled the price, and I couldn't afford it. And Columbia said no, and I had to deliver the film, and I threw Night Moves in because I had no choice. There was no time to even think.
Wow.
I hated that as a climax.
Yeah, interesting.
I hated that as a climax. It was all wrong. It's like all the way to Night Moves is wrong.
Yeah, I know, because it comes after punk, and I've been like, what? I mean, I thought this was just
terrible.
Some sick joke on your part to have Night Moves there.
That's an interesting thought. I may tell the next reviewer that. It was a sick joke on the fucking Columbia's part. They should have bought the other goddamn song.
Yeah,
they gotten everything else so cheap.
Yeah. Well,
what was that song? It was
I really want to know too. But if it comes up, maybe we'll interject here.
It was perfect.
I wanted to talk with you a little bit, going back to this idea of the dream process that you're in, about subconscious symbolism, which is there throughout your work. I mean, in Fritz the Cat, there's the great irony of the pigs invading the synagogue, which I always loved. And you have, of course, in Coonskin, the infamous Miss America scene. And I'm curious, because this is interesting to me. Here you are as an animator. You're doing 24 cells a second. So you have possibly more attention going on to symbols and the like. And yet you turned out the scripts really quick.
Right.
And so my question to you is, well, is it not really so much about the conception? It's more about the execution? That this is where the symbols come from? That you perfect the abstract or the ambiguities?
Good, very good. Let me try to make this understandable, because it's not quite understandable to me yet. But I'm closer than I used to be, and then I burnt out, so I lost it. Which I did, I burnt out. The process I use is collage and montage, and I love music. What I am willing to do, and what I think should be done, is to rewrite and rewrite and daydream and rewrite. So most of the symbols came. You write something down and you think it's right, but then you know there's something wrong about it, so you keep thinking about it. I have to drive animators crazy. My best scenes came from me lying on a couch, not letting go of it, playing music. The music makes the dreams in my mind. Every time I hear music that I love, I get visuals if I'm quiet on a couch. So the stuff like, let's take Heavy Traffic. For some unexplained reason, Carol turns into a crow when Michael gets shot. I have this black girl who turns into a crow and starts screaming and flying around Michael's head. I don't know what it means. I just know it felt right. And the point is, it came from me daydreaming on listening to the song. Originally, the script had her there screaming her head off, as a girl would if a boyfriend just got killed. But she turned into a crow. And I said, this works. I can't tell you why. I'm going with it. Because I saw her in my dream turning into a crow and running around Michael's head, but I didn't know why. In Coonskin, the Godfather's mother, if they kill her, falls into this sort of cocoon and a little butterfly comes out. And they kill the butterfly with their hand. That was very late in the picture. That was a dream. They shot her. She died. But as I kept working on the theme, da-da-da-da-da-da, the butterfly came up. And I didn't hesitate. The thing is, so 90% of my best stuff comes out of rewriting, re-daydreaming, rethinking. And I didn't necessarily have to have a reason with being the producer and being the director and being the writer. Who the fuck's going to tell me no? So the point is, that's why so much stuff got in. Another director would have to go to the producer, knock on his door, and say, oh, listen, I just got Carol turning into a bird. I just think, what do you mean? What does that mean? Well, I don't know what it means. Well, then why are you doing it? Well, it just felt right. What are you out of your mind? No one's going to understand why you... I said, well, no, I don't want anybody to understand why. But all those questions weren't asked of me. I had total freedom. Yeah. So all these things... I never let go of a picture. I must have rewrote them as they went. Once they're in production, the script didn't matter to me. The end of Traffic, I'll tell you what the end of Traffic was. Michael never got shot. Huh. The end of my original Traffic in script form.
Yeah.
Was everybody was chasing everybody through the city real. The Godfather was chasing Angie, and Angie was chasing Carol, and Carol was chasing Michael, you know, but really through the streets, like a dumb chase. You know, a slapstick, stupid chase. And AIP loved that. That was a great way to end it. Oh, this is funny. I wrote it. That's the best I could do at the time. And I hated it, but I wrote it. I didn't know what I was going to do at the end. And the picture's going on. I'm heading for that scene. I know I'm in trouble. I don't like it. I don't know why I don't like it. It just doesn't feel right. It seems wrong for the integrity of the film. Mm-hmm. I remember, well, it's a funny scene, but it doesn't have the same integrity as everything else. And I'm lying around, walking around, cursing, singing a bar, I don't remember. And Shorty blows Michael's head apart. It just came to me. So, and in Michael's head, as he was falling apart, came all the pinballs and everything. Yeah. Well, that represented the chase. Yeah. You see, that instead of taking this real chase, all that stuff represented the chase. That, and the whole thing turned into a great fucking end. And I put it in. And the animators started screaming at me because they started the chase. I said, I don't want this. Why don't you want this? It's dumb, guys. Well, I'm the boss, guys. Yes, sir, Mr. Bakshi. So I took it off the desks, and I put this in. It was just, that was my chase. That was the chase backing up into a metaphor. I work my pictures like that all the time. Of course, some stuff I let go is terrible, and some stuff I never catch. Yeah. And some stuff is not as good as I wanted it to be. So it works the other way. Yeah. But my great moments that I love to this day came quite late and out of music, out of daydreaming, out of sitting in a bar, you know, and just thinking about it. It was very hard to continuously think it. It hurts. You know, you want to let go. You want to forget the God. You know, but I just would stay on it like a... And I would feel emotionally that something was wrong, but I couldn't explain it. I'm not very literate, so I can't... I don't use words very well, but I use images very well. So everything I do has to come out of an image. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of stuff. But when Michael's head blew up and all that pinball stuff was inside representing the chase, I said, oh my God.
Yeah.
And you know, so it was those moments that I remember for the rest of my life. And they taught me what art's about. Those moments taught me that art can't be explained and very hard to explain it, but you have to go with it. And sometimes it's wrong and sometimes it's right, but... That's what I loved about the freedom I had that I took. I took that freedom.
I'm wondering if this is why you often have long shots in your film. I think, of course, we were talking about I'm a Nigger Man, and that whole thing is just extremely simple. It's just as, like, Jimi Hendrix playing an American Pop, or even, you know, a number of scenes throughout your film in which it's just this extended take, essentially. I'm wondering if you do this because it's kind of a piece to put into the puzzle as you're reworking things and retinkering things and the like.
If I've got a long... I don't remember everything now. If I've got... Yes, retinkering. No. If I've got a long shot or a long take, I am setting up a motion. There must be a beautiful piece of music in it. In other words, if I got a long take or a long wide shot or a long scene, I'm moving in slowly. It's because I'm setting up emotionally with the music, and I want that music to play. Whereas some, you know, you don't let me... directors don't let music play enough in films, or at least in those days. So I don't remember specifically. Each scene has a different reason. But a lot of times I went big so I can like move in, let the music set up my audience. I'm usually coming out of one kind of emotion, heading for another kind of emotion, and I need a transition. So that's part of the montage or collage. Now, the guy that taught me that, the guy that I love very much, was Serge Eisenstein. Alexander Nevsky and Potemkin, that early Russian director was absolutely brilliant. I mean, look at him now, he's a little slow. But when I first saw him, I fell down. The compositions, his use of music, his use of collage, his use of just how he felt about everything. Everything felt. You feel the director feeling everything. So he was very important to me as a film director. And in Wizards, I used his stuff. I used the battle scene. I just lifted Nevsky and rotoscoped it and threw it right into the battle. I love the guy so much. So, but Nevsky, and what I read most about Nevsky, other than his films, which could get slow at times, especially today, was his storyboards and his discussions. I read his essays on movies, and they forget about the beautiful.
Speaking of music, Prokofiev. I mean, right. There you go.
And his feeling about how important music was. So I would say that guy, and it was Russian Jew, and I am, so that guy taught me an awful lot. And I used to sneak into the studio and not tell the guys, because they were all into, you know, Warner Brothers and Chuck Jones and those guys, and I'm trying to let them know that this guy is the guy. I'm doing animated cartoons, but this is my guy. I forget how much I studied him, how much he taught me. I just forgot till now.
I would argue that contemporary filmmakers should probably go back to Eisenstein, because they're now going to MTV, and they should go much further. In fact, if you look at a lot of Eisenstein's cutting, it's far more precise and motivated.
Absolutely.
than the Pietro Scalia line of editing. I can't stand that school.
Well, no question about it. I mean, the man was so brilliant. His bad pictures, the pictures never finished. I saw stills and stuff of the stuff he did in Mexico. My God, they were gorgeous. Yeah. Skulls in the foreground of Mexico. I mean, forget it. The man knew exactly what he wanted, exactly how something should feel, and exactly music played in the part of movies. And he's a complete package to me. He was my teacher. If I had a point at any, it was Eisenstein.
But as a mentor, you're responsible for, of course, Ren and Stimpy's John Kay, but that's also, right. I can never forgive you for unleashing Thomas Kinkade and giving him a big break out into the world.
That son of a bitch. Kinkade was the coolest. If Kinkade wasn't a painter, he'd be one of those cult leaders.
Really?
Kinkade came into my office, him and James Gurney. James Gurney did Don Atropolis. So both these kids come in. Jim Gurney's very good. Those dinosaurs that came alive in the world. You know, those series of books. But Kinkade comes to my office as a kid. I'm looking for background artists. He's a good painter. And did a spiel. Wonderful. In the middle of the picture, he stands up and he says, I'm going away with Gurney for 3 weeks. We're traveling across country. So I said, whoa, we're doing a picture. Says, I will be back at a certain date. We will paint enough before we go. Really? And when we get back, we'll do double paintings.
Did he do the double paintings?
Right to everything.
Okay.
There's nothing. Oh, well, but he made all these deals. He hated Jews. He told me that, but I said, but you know, I'm Jewish as well. You know, I felt like a
kid. But you have the money. That's.
He was very. Okay. Now, he worked with Frank Frazetta. Those kids, Gurney and Kinkade, painted wonderful paintings so fast, so light, and where he got his, and Frank Frazetta would come in, who was a great illustrator, and show Kinkade a lot of tricks. How he went out and did what he did is beyond my understanding now. Both of those guys, when they painted other stuff, when Kinkade painted closer to the Ashcan school that I love very much, and Hopper was wonderful, so he's very, very talented. He's very, very much of a hustler. Those two, and a good one. Those two things are in conflict. He can sell anything. He opened up galleries. They went out of business. He's building a city now that looks like his cabins. He raises this hundreds of millions of dollars. He owns half of California. I speak to Gurney about him. Gurney says, listen. You know, so I have nothing against Kinkade. He's funny. He's so funny. I mean, he is like Elma Gantry. I mean, I just, this guy is, you know, I mean, but is he talented? Oh, yeah. Will he paint anything to make money? Oh, yeah. Does he have any sort of moralistic view? No, he doesn't care about anything. He's as cheesy and as cheap as they come. But, you know, he's a great painter, but he likes to make money, and he does. He doesn't like the stuff he's painting. I had kind of say he doesn't like this stuff he's doing.
But this is anathema to your particular position, which is about making it as true and as honest as possible. And so I'm wondering how money enters this equation here.
But by the time I got to Fire and Ice and Frazetta, I don't really, it's not my picture. I mean, yeah. I was burnt. I was through. I don't consider Fire and Ice, so people may like it or not. I don't consider that a Backstreet film. That's a Frazetta film. That's me just, that's me not caring. I mean, I was burnt out.
Yeah.
I had too many fights. I ran studios too long. I was tired. And other things, which I'm not going to tell you. I was burnt. It wasn't a Backstreet film. I could care less. But at that point, I was gone. And I did. I closed the studio down and left. So, no, Fire and Ice wasn't anything that I would consider. Did I have any feelings about Mara Litzer? It was over with. Frank was having a good time. Frazetta, who I love. If he's happy, I'm happy. Because I brought him out to L.A., Kincaid and Gurney are happy. Let them be happy. You know, but leave me out of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Frank would interview all the ladies, come in and make him get undressed to look like one of his Frazetta girls. He liked that. I liked that. The girls would come through, you know, auditioning for the part, rotoscope.
Yeah.
But I had no emotional interest in Fire and Ice, to tell you the truth.
I wanted to also ask you, in relation to the daydreaming impulse, you have a tendency to have a responsive aspect to your films, whether it is rotoscoping or whether it's using a photograph. And I'm curious about this. I mean, where does the imagination take place, or do you just naturally need some kind of visual element or sound element to respond to in order to operate as an artist?
You smart motherfucker. Really? Well, yes, I do. In other words, well, not that I think I have to. I think it's crucial. You have to respond emotionally. You have to get in the mood. It's very hard to explain. I would sometimes drink a lot of scotch or vodka to get into a mood. I love art. Art says everything. And if art grabs me emotionally, it teaches me something. Sometimes what it's teaching you, don't understand. So I am endlessly looking at visuals in those days. Not as much anymore. Especially photographers. I love the New York School of Photography, Arbus and Ouija and newspaper. But, you know, I am crazy over photographs. And photographs have certain textures. If you look at the corners of photographs, take a whole photograph of that Eisenstadt, somebody did it in the shtetl of Europe. Forget that guy's name, you know, Jewish guy who shot before the Nazis got to it. If you look at these photographs and you go to a little corner, square that big, you'll see something amazing, a bottle in the window, a face distorted. I mean, people look at a photograph, I look at it, then I try to get little windows and stuff, and it all turns you on a certain way. So art is what I breathe and eat, and it's crucial. I mean, Hopper, when I first discovered Hopper as a young man, with my education was slow, I mean, look how much Hopper was involved in heavy traffic emotionally. Not just visually,
yeah,
but how he feels. How did Hopper... So Reginald Marsh and Hopper covered so much of traffic. And Ouija. And yeah. So I'm saying, yeah, these people are to be loved. What I'm saying is, you know, most studios, when they do an animated feature like Disney or something, will get a designer. They'll hire a great designer like Mary Blair or someone. And the entire film looked designed in that style. They call it style. I montage. I go from painted backgrounds to photographs, from photographs to nothing. I mean, I don't believe in style. I believe what's emotionally right for a film. Mm-hmm. So every artist that I love is part of my movies, yeah, including my sensibilities about what I love about them. I don't believe in one style. There is no such thing as style. There's only montage, collage, and emotion. It's right for the scene, it's the right style. So do I look at, oh yeah, I listen to music, I look at pictures. I also burnt out because this is a constant stream of looking and searching and loving. You know, it's not easy. And then retaining that, you know, remembering it, not copying it, retaining it.
Yeah.
Trying to get to what you liked about it, but not what it is. That's a ripoff. What do you like about this green color in a Hoppe painting, and how did that reflect on the color you choose for Ida's dress? That's how I used to work, and I can't do that anymore.
Well, with a painting, you're dealing with a single canvas here, as opposed to...
I'm doing with painting, but it's not as painful, and it's not as... it's different. It's different because in those days, I didn't care where I got my inspiration. I mean, I wasn't so precious about it. I mean, I had so many influences, you know, because I was living a life in the village and running around drinking and, you know, fucking around, so... There were so many influences. I wasn't into being an artist. You see, I wasn't into being an artist. I became an artist when all this information that I was gathering finally forced me to paint pictures. At that point, I wasn't an artist. I was just a guy that had to do this. I can't explain it. I didn't have no pretenses about me being any good. I'm serious. It just was the right way to go, and I'm teaching myself, having never gone to college, so it's a question of me finding instructors and books. It's a very strange process I went through.
But you were training yourself here to be an artist. You worked long hours to...
I didn't know that at the time. I know now.
Yeah.
I'm telling you in retrospect.
Yeah.
Then it was just the work that I think I've got to do. I'm not clear why I have to do this, but I'm going to do it. I mean, I wasn't clear about a lot of stuff. There were no light bulbs that went over my head and said, this is right and this is wrong.
Yeah.
It's only after the... When I saw heavy traffic, I fell down. I said, did I say that? Did not my mother say that to me? I mean... It was as big a shock to me when my mother lifted a skirt to me in the ballroom and said, I can't believe I did that. I mean, you know, so...
Wait, so you're actually having some sense of, I can't believe I did that, even though you gave yourself complete unfettered restriction here?
Well,
it seems a bit odd.
It felt right at the time.
Yeah.
But when it came back to me off the screen and knocked me out of my chair, it's a different thing to do something at your desk.
Yeah.
Out of context. It's another thing to see it in the flow of a film emotionally. Two different things happen. When you go in to see your movie, you're seeing it for the first time like everyone else. You got all these pieces you put together. You're hoping you're right, now you're screening. There's stuff in traffic I couldn't believe I said, and of course stayed there. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's the biggest surprise to me as anyone else. Believe me. You know.
Well, I mean,
well, that's psychological. That's working in a daydream.
Yeah.
That's working in a dream. That's not letting myself know what I'm saying. Oh, that's working. That's me not being honest with myself. I'm being honest with the picture, but I'm not being honest with myself. I'm not saying that's my mother. I'm saying that's Ida. At the point I'm doing it, later on it's my mother. Because the scene before was her walking through the ballroom with all those photographs. That's my family back there.
Yeah.
That's my uncle. So I'm saying, now I understand what I'm doing. You know, so then it was just old photographs. You see what I mean? It's like you're painting a picture. You're not sure why it's happening.
I'm wondering if...
That's a hard thing. I can't explain it better than that.
Well, it's interesting because you're talking about this idea of daydreaming, but I also think that you escape into these daydreams because then any sense of guilt or judgment for putting something out that is shocking is completely eliminated because it's
absolutely
the subconscious.
Right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's not me doing this. It's something inside.
Yeah.
It's not me. Absolutely right. I never did these films. Someone else did these films. I don't know who did these films. Somebody sitting inside me are responsible for these movies. Not me.
Yeah.
I'm serious. Not now. That's how I feel now. That's why I can't do it. I haven't done a movie in a long time. I can't get back there.
Well, what about this? The Last Days of Coney Island? Is that even actually happening? Or?
No, I'll tell you about that. But you know what you're talking about. I stopped because I couldn't get to where I couldn't get back. I couldn't get there anymore. So I think either I shouldn't be going back, or I'm on the wrong track, so I'm thinking about it. It was a good pulp movie, you know, a good detective, you know, but it wasn't, I don't know, there's something wrong with the whole fucking thing, so I stopped it to rethink it.
Was it the computers that you were using for this?
No, it was the characters. I wasn't being honest.
Interesting.
I wasn't being honest.
By putting last in the title, it's almost as if you knew, I suppose, that this was your last chance of restoring the animation? Or?
No, because the country's dying, and the country, I think, is dying. Obama's our last chance, or there's going to be a revolution. We can't go through Bush, and Clinton's have sold out totally, and during this campaign, I can't believe how shallow they both became and cheesy and cheap. Obama's got really trying. He's very young, and there's something wrong with what we're doing, all of this stuff. And last days of Coney Island really have to do with America collapsing, because Coney Island was where we all went for entertainment, and now it's gone. See, Coney Island is destroyed. Yeah. The real, when I went to Coney Island, it was a bristling, wonderful thing. It's now decrepit and gone. So
they just shut down a good chunk of it over the,
it must have been gone for a long time. Yeah.
I know. Well, what little sliver there was, and it keeps being hacked away
that's
and
right.
being developed.
It's garbage. It's garbage. So that's what the picture's supposed to be about, but I couldn't get there yet, so I stopped it. In other words, I couldn't make these transitional things I was doing in traffic. What we're talking about doesn't seem to want to happen. So, maybe I can't because I'm painting, and the painting is, maybe everything's going on a canvas. Maybe I was thinking that maybe everything I'm doing is being put on a canvas, and why bother with film? Because that's what I'm doing on my canvases. So maybe that's it. Maybe I shouldn't go back to film, just stay painting. We had a show at the Amazing Gallery. I sold 8 paintings. I made some money. It blew me away. I mean, I didn't expect. That's the most I've ever sold in my life, ever. And maybe that's where I'm putting it. So maybe I can't go back for that reason. Don't forget, animation was my only medium when I did those films. Now I paint. And that's very important to me. So maybe that's it. But it never reached the level of what I wanted to be, which is what I wanted to be, which is this country's full. Has fallen apart intellectually and morally. And look at I don't want to tell you, you probably know, this war, what are we doing? And our president still gets up and says, patience and what? And the country should be marching to the streets. And how do we go, we've had enough, but how do we go to war as a country with only a certain sect of the people fighting and the rest of us not on the war footing, making money and getting tax breaks, it makes no sense. If you're at war, the whole country's got to be into it, not just a group of volunteers. So it's but none of us care anymore, and that's what's wrong. We get the president we deserve. Whoever this country votes in next time, whoever will get the president deserves. I told my wife that Bush we deserve because we voted him in one way or another, or when he robbed it, we didn't do anything. A country will get the president it needs, and whoever gets the next represents who we are. And if we don't vote Obama in, we're through. That's my belief, because Hillary and Bill are bullshit artists, and they're shallow, and they're not even bright. And McCain's another Bush we can't do. He still wants to fight the fucking war. He's still talking about be patient. I don't want to be patient. I want to bring the boys home. We'll get the whole country there. Mm-hmm. So if Obama gets robbed, which he might in superdelegates, because he's going to win the popular thing, this country and the country accepts it, then we deserve to get what we get. That's what I wanted the last days to be about, sort of that we have lost our moral standards. Yeah. The Judeo-Christian thing that I grew up with, the bohemian, is gone with. There's nothing ethical left to us anymore. There's nothing that's even a secret. There's not even fake ethics anymore. There isn't the fact that we look up to a president, even though he may not be right, but we protect him in a feeling of aura. Now I have news people screaming at my presidents to be in talk shows. Oh, you got a minute now. Hurry up and get off the screen. Let's go. You've heard enough cutting guys off who may be president. They should say to this newscaster, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
I'm president of the United States, either you let. I'm running for president of the United States, either you let me finish what I have to say, or I'm walking off this. They stay, they take their orders, because they want to be on CNN, and that disgusts me. Would Eisenhower do that? No. Would Roosevelt do that? No. Would Teddy Roosevelt do that? No. Which president that I respect, whether I like his opinion, would take that from a goddamn newscaster who's nothing, but all those guys up there did. Now, whoa, if that's president material, I'm Mickey Mantle.
Yeah. It occurs to me as you're describing the American that is dying, that has died.
Yeah.
You said that you had burnt out and that Fire and Ice was not a true Bakshi film.
Right.
I'm wondering, since film is a medium that is very much in the present.
Right.
Whether maybe your inability to really access it as truly as you feel that you did with your other films, your earlier films, is symptomatic of this, that the painting is something that will hang and represent the past, and as a result, reflects a truer sense of what your spirit is, which is tied into this earlier America.
I'm very much tied into what, that's very well put. I'm very much tied into who we were, what we strived for, what we did, what we did in World War II, how we built the country, how we protected our democracy. I'm into all of that that we used to be, and what we are now disgusts me. And I'm trying to hold on to what we should be, and it's just slipping away. And I think it's, I'm becoming a huge problem. I'm very terrified as to what might happen.
Well, it's interesting because the PBS special you did was about America. It was your statement on America. So what I'm sort of suggesting here and what I'm getting from what you're saying is that essentially what you do as an artist, whether it's painting or films, is your relationship to America,
of
essentially.
Of course. Oh, absolutely. It's all about America. Yeah. About my country. It's about my parents. It's about what America... It's all about America. It's the metaphor I start with, all the time. Yeah. That's my subject. Yeah. All of us. That's my, and who we are within this America. Absolutely. Yeah. I love this country, and I love who we are, who we used to be. So.
And there was a time where you felt compatible with America?
Absolutely. It was
and you no longer feel compatible?
Or? I don't feel compatible. There was America that had more integrity now. There's America that before Nixon, before Kennedy got shot, before King got shot, before Malcolm X got shot, there was an America that all worked together. There was America that will never lie what's going on now in Iraq without screaming and marching to the... Where are the marching? Where are the street marches? There's America that got blacks to vote by marching out there in the 60s. I mean, that was people trying to make the country better through its faults. No country is perfect. Today, everyone's greedy, grabs what they could, makes as much money as they could, rip off, lie. Look what's going on. Look at the scams on the. We thought Enron, that big thing that everyone never happened again. Look at them. Everyone's made fortunes in the mortgage business, and this business. Oil companies people are making hundreds of millions of dollars while guys can't get out of their tours in Iraq. That's not America.
Well, the film environment, too. I mean, someone like Bill Plimpton, who's an amazing underground animator,
right.
He should be a national treasure in this country.
Right.
He is known in Europe.
That's
right. He's here in the city. He works in the city.
I know Bill very well, but I have to call Bill.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. Could I go now? I'm exhausted.
Oh.
We could do it again, but I just burnt
out. No, no worries.
Have you got enough? We could do it. I just burnt out.
Oh, it's no problem.
I love your question. I'd love to do it again if you want to.
Sure, no problem. If you're in town.
I've had it.
Okay, no problem. Well, Ralph, it was a pleasure.
I love the questions you asked. I would love to spend more time with these.
Sure.
And I want to be clear. If we ever do it again, I want it earlier.
Okay, sure.
Because you're tough. And you ask good questions. Okay. I want to be on my toes.
Okay, no problem.
You're asking some very important questions that no one's ever asked, especially this last question here. I want to be able to do this again with you at a different time when I'm fresher.